Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening. This is Gwen on the Blender over at DaughtersOfIsis.com and Daughters of Isis Makers, and we sponsor the show, The Consciousness Shift. Tonight, our guest is to be author Cliff Sernheim, who has just written a really another wonderful book. Let me find my notes. Cliff's a little bit late getting here today, but he will. His latest book is called Seasons of the Sacred Earth. It's a real goodie, and he's a little bit late calling in. I'm going to play a little break-in music here, something that I think we all can use today, a little old cream for you. And hopefully Cliff will get here by then. If he doesn't, we'll spend out some time talking about his endeavors.
I am indeed.
Wow. It's good to hear you. It's just you and I this evening. Nicole is at a wedding in Philadelphia, so I'll miss her. I've also put in for the last half of the show that if anyone wants to call in, they could do that. Is that okay with you?
Sounds good.
Yeah, you are enjoying some really wonderful success with Seasons of the Sacred Earth.
Seems to be. I don't know the exact results for about 6 months yet, but yeah, people are. I've actually been quite surprised that, delightedly surprised that the book has received the reception it has. People have been very happy with it. I can't even keep up with the email right now. I've always tried to respond to everybody, and getting a lot of emails these days. So I think so. I've been even amused at some of the ways that the book has been successful. It's currently one of Amazon's best-selling travel books, and it was not written to be a travel book, so I suppose that's good.
That's unusual. That's really wonderful to hear, though. And why, give me a good example, because I have yet to read it. I'm terrible. I know. I should have read it before I had you on again. I just haven't actually been able to get the book yet. But why are they calling it a wonderful travel guide?
Why are they calling it a what?
A wonderful travel guide.
Oh. I think Nova Scotia has a sense of mystique, and the book does explore a lot of mystique. And it happens to be in Nova Scotia, though it's really more an incidental thing. The book is not written about Nova Scotia mystique. It's written about the spiritual, magical, and physical joys of living very closely with nature. Nova Scotia is the setting, so it perhaps appeals partly due to that. Nova Scotia has a historical resonance for a lot of people too, especially up and down the East Coast. Much of the population of Nova Scotia is Gaelic, particularly Scots Gaelic, and there was a lot of immigration between New England and Nova Scotians, and so that Gaelic and that links and those cultural links run all up and down the Canadian Maritimes and New England. Could be part of it too. It's something of a haven as well for artists and homesteaders. The province is green and natural, and the population's low. It's very wooded. It looks a lot like, honestly, like Ireland. So there's that bit of appeal.
I would imagine.
Yeah. So that would be my guess as to how it keeps coming up there.
Right. However it finds its way, you tell a great tale. You really do. I mean, I keep up with you on your blog. I've gone over there and read it a few times. It's a nice little break. And you do wonderful posts on Facebook. You give a description of the day or the place or the event that, especially all of how you are, your daily life there, living raw, as it were, on the land. And it's a break from the tropical setting I'm in, that's in the middle of I'm on the coastline, but it's still an urban, area. And when I read your posts, I get a sense of being out in that wonderful, mystical, wooded area that everybody is drawn to from, I imagine, in the book, too, the descriptions. I wanted to ask you if you could discuss a little bit about how you find the value or the spirit of a place. Do you, just to reflect back to the audience and to people who are wondering, I mean, I think it's all sort of a personal system or intuition. Still, there are reasons and there are things that we can learn from our elders and from culture that give us those flags that tell us this is the spirit of this land, not just the human history, but you're very good at describing what's going on with the animal life, the environmental, the natural habitat that surrounds things, and reflecting it back as, the spirit of the land. And if we could talk about that a little bit.
Certainly. Can you clarify a little bit more what you're looking for there? I'll ask you a therapy question there. Tell me more.
Well, I'll tell you what. I know how I go out and find. I think everybody has a favorite place, a place that is special to them. Not everybody. That's my point. But everybody I know who works within nature and who's looking to clarify the distinction of spirit in nature. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's something that we, you know, a lot of us read Nature Speak by Ted Andrews, or go and pick up Otterzell's Wizard Handbook. There's a lot of information, the augury. Do you sense where I'm coming from, Cliff?
Yes.
In other words, when people journey out, and there's a lot of people who ask questions, there's a lot of folks interested, especially people who are so, have choose to be in a city environment too. There's also a way for them to find the spirit of place, and a place where they can find spirit that will be that favorite place outside their own, where they go to renew. I mean, there's gardens, there's parks, and I thought we could talk about that. You know, from the wild environment right on into the urban, because I think both are important right now.
Yeah. So how does one go about getting a sense of what is a sacred place?
Right.
What it's about?
How do they recognize that tickle within themselves that's telling them that, you know?
Boy, that is a really good question, and answering it is I think it's especially difficult for me, because I have lived so much of my life in wild places that I have not really given a thought in particular to the nature of getting along with those wild places throughout much of my life. In fact, as I posted earlier today, when I did my morning post about things at the homestead or the books and whatnot, mm-hmm. that the way these various books had their starts, and Seasons of the Sacred Earth had its start mainly because I would now and then I would write a small story for like an online magazine like Witchvox, or to I would write a small story as kind of a drawn out journal, a memento to myself of an event that had happened around the homestead or some other time with myself or my wife or my kids, and our lives intertwined with nature. And I would write this out as a memento, sort of a way of working through it. And things began to become clearer to me. Anyway, people would hear those stories, read those stories if they happen to end up online or in Witchbox or some magazine or whatnot. And people would say, you should write about this stuff. And eventually the idea occurred to me that, okay, I guess I should, because to me, getting along with the land, living with the land and by the land, living with its magic, this was something I had done for so long that to me it wasn't a skill, it wasn't a technique to teach. It was just the way one approached life. Like in truth, I get more and more requests to teach bushcraft skills these days, to teach things like permaculture or gardening and tracking and such. And
I had never even
heard of the word bushcraft till about 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. To me, these were just skills of life. This is how you're supposed to go out to live. And so after we came back to Nova Scotia from Alaska, and I had a bit more chance to sort of be in touch with the outside world, I knew from an academic standpoint that people had a hard time identifying with nature, and people had a hard time identifying with more rural life, because I knew that, what is it now, I think 80% of the population lives in urban areas. Even if they live in small towns, life essentially mimics urban areas, because you don't get your food from your barnyard anymore. You get your food from the grocery store. You get your water from a main as opposed to drawing from a well or a spring. I mean, life has changed so much. And so bringing people back into that intuitive sense of the land, how to express this in words was something that honestly I have struggled with for quite a while, how to put this into words in an actual sense, how to make sense of that. To me, there's an old concept in old Celtic history. It's known as Awen, the sacred inspiration. It's known by, you know, in classical history as being in touch with the muse. In science and in comparative religion, it's known as the peak experience, when you experience this moment of the sublime in your life. And I think when people enter a garden or they walk into a forest, they find or beside a brook, they find some place that really touches them and fills them up with a sense of timelessness, of the divine, of magic and energy and specialness. That is a clue that's in the heart, and I don't honestly know that there is any special technique that one finds for that path. I know that there are some things that are important in one's life. A fellow named Mario Beauregard wrote a book it's 5 or 6 years ago now, a book that I just thought was wonderful called The Spiritual Brain. And in this book, he did an immense study over many years on the peak experience, on that sense of being in touch with the divine, and what it meant, and how what a difference it made in one's life. And being a scientist, he wanted to categorize what was involved in finding that magical connection or that mystical connection with the sublime in nature and in life in general. And he was able to identify, among other things, being altruistic, meaning to help others, being empathetic, caring about others' feelings. He identified about a dozen things, and one of the key elements was being in touch with the natural world around us. All these things together, or any number of combinations of these things, seem to develop within every human being an ability to sense those special magical moments in magical places. Now, my own experience makes me also think that the more we're able to slow down and time our own lives and move our own lives in harmony with the patterns of the of nature, with the seasons, with the lives of animals and the rains and such, the more that we become even more in tune with that, the more important those things become to us. And for me, what I like is the idea that we move from having a peak experience to having a peak life, where we live in this state of being more and more in touch. I'm not perfect. I certainly am not there, but I think it's a goal that one can aim for, because it's almost zen. It brings happiness. It brings a deep sense of fulfillment, and it allows you to know that you're going through every day doing something to make a better world in every sense, for people, for nature, for the animals, for the spirits we share the world with. Does that make sense? Does that answer the question?
I think it makes perfect sense. Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it makes perfect sense. And what I'm getting at is that touchstone within that you speak about within all of us that knows the peak experience. We all have them in one way or another. And when people are yearning to recreate those experiences within nature with a greater consciousness of the event, because I think folks are not conscious of the stuff that really triggers inside of them, that puts them in connection with the earth and the environment. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go, no, please.
I was
go
gonna
ahead.
Say, you know that my profession, I'm a psychotherapist. I'm sorry, say that again?
Oh, yes, I do, actually.
Okay. And so psychotherapists, clinical social workers, certified counselors, all of us that work in this type of field where we're daily working with human psychology, animal psychology, and such, there is a concept that we're deeply and sometimes painfully aware of, and that's that by and large human beings are unconscious. You were talking about becoming more conscious of things and unconscious of things, and how our lives have led us to becoming unconscious. By and large, humans are very unconscious. Unconsciousness is defined as going through life without a sense of where one's feelings and motivations come from, where what drives our actions, what drives our choices. And, you know, in therapy, these days therapy has become very practical. We try to move people in the direction of resolving whichever dilemma it is that they're experiencing, whether it's emotional or something more tangible when they come to see us. We're moving in that direction. But ultimately, if we had any number of sessions and any number of times to work with people, we would like to move them in the direction of becoming more conscious, where they're aware more deeply of all these things, and that means the world around us. It's very hard to be conscious in the world around us. The world that as it's contrived just now, this human invention of civilization and the way that it exists just at this moment is really quite antagonistic to really being conscious.
Yeah.
I mean, the vast majority of people, they wake up in the morning or the evening, whatever their work time is. They have to go to work. They have to do their job, whether or not they like it. For many people, they do their jobs to the point where they're so skilled at it, even if the job is mentally demanding. They can be off somewhere else, dreaming about their next vacation or a plan they're going to do on the weekend or whatnot. They go through their day. They make their plans to get together to have fun. They watch TV. There's always some form of entertainment going on these days. People are constantly walking around with data phones or iPads or tablets or laptops. It's as if everything within conspires to create a disconnect, but not just from the world around us, from our own conscious. It's, you know, one of the reasons that I everybody that knows me knows I've harped against technology for ages, and it's not that I don't like technology in and of itself. It has its place, but we've allowed it to bring us to a point where we're deeply, deeply disconnected. I mean, my homestead here, I know about primitive technology. I teach some techniques in primitive technology. Primitive technology is skills that the ancients would use, such as carving their own bows to hunt game or making beer the old way, or making a fire with flint and steel, things like that. I know how to do those things. But it's not that I wouldn't rather just as soon use a match. I just as soon use a match to start a fire. And certainly I have a computer sitting in front of me right now. It's what I write on, and it's how I update my posts. But the idea is to have everything in balance, to be able to put the thing aside. I have a friend, and I'll just mention his name because it'll bug him. His name is Paul Koverman, and he's the CEO of Survival Schools Canada, which is not a survivalist school. They're not any kind of militant group. He teaches people things like wilderness survival skills.
Right.
He's also an excellent medic. He was trained with the British military. He's an expert in field medicine, and he teaches that too. Great guy. But he has a rule. When people attend his classes, they cannot bring their data devices. No tablets, no iPads, no phones, no nothing. They have to rebuild that connection and learn to be in touch with the world around them. To the point. And that's painful for people. Talk to me about it. He talks about for people where it's so painful, it's almost impossible for them. You can just see them struggling with that desire to when there's a still moment and they could listen to their thoughts or hear the sound of the owls around them or whatever is going on, they're struggling against that impulse to pull out whatever creates the disconnect and disconnect.
Yeah.
Probably worth a book in itself to explore why humans have that compulsion to disconnect.
Well, it's. I was having a conversation with somebody. When I do a seminar, sometimes I'll talk because I will talk about a blend I've created, and it represents perhaps the Egyptian god Anubis. But I speak about, you know, how would you like to have been a Greek who traveled and, you know, described the Greek with his sandaled feet traveling to the edges of Egypt, and he comes to these big pillars, and an Egyptian comes up, and he's wearing this eye makeup, much like a football player, to keep the sun out of his eyes. He's adorned in gold and beads and jewelry that's far superior to anything he's ever seen, and the guy smells good, you know? Whereas a Grecian traveler in those days would have smelled horrifying, you know, to us. But the point is that you can travel people back, you know, with storytelling, but they get a sense of what it was like to be in touch with the earth and in touch with your sensual nature, like your vision, your sense of smell and taste, and the sense of feel that you would have just walking on unprepared roadways, you know. And it gives you a sense of what the earth means to us. And I think that's very important right now. It seems like we're getting ready to blow some of it up more. I think folks are having, I think we're having a massive human panic attack about now. Critical thinking people are wondering how, you know, the next generations will mutate and survive type of thing. And so folks are reaching out for what there is, because I can go down to the beach and I'm on the east coast of South Florida where there's a lot in the water that is very scary. And gosh knows there's oxygen depletion or what have you. Still, I can go out, and some days I can even see from the shoreline the Gulf Stream. And it's still beautiful, Cliff. It's still very, very beautiful. The sea is my woods, you know. I grew up out there, and I love it. But the thing is, I think people want to reach out and get in. They're using all of these spiritual, if you will, practices to come to some kind of terms with that trigger inside that gives them, that brings that peak experience that they can hold at heart because they really haven't, or if you will, as the therapist, to achieve a consciousness.
Yes.
That includes the earth. Is that what it simply is?
Is that what?
Is that what it simply is to achieve a consciousness that includes Mother Earth, that includes our complete environment. Sensually.
I would tend to, wait. Sorry, go ahead.
What would that sensual awakening?
Yeah, that's well said, and it's a good question, and I would say, yeah, people ever more are having a deep desire to reconnect. People ever more are recognizing that their lives are off kilter. What I find in my work as a therapist is often they know their lives are off kilter. They just don't know how. They think the next trip to Cuba or the Caribbean or the bigger house or whatnot is going to fix that. But then, you know, we see people being drawn by droves these days to lifestyles that are like rewilding, which is a very primitive kind of nature-oriented life, or homesteading like Daff and I do, where one is seeking to immerse into nature simply, maybe with some technological augmentations, but seeking to immerse and live very harmoniously with nature. We see people turning to backward in terms of fiction and stories. Many of the movies and the stories coming out these days are very nature-centered, very past-centered.
Yeah.
We see people also, we see huge developments of interest just in the last decade or two in the concept of bushcraft, learning woodsmanship skills, learning outdoor skills. And, you know, whereas in the 80s this was going on, you had strange radical people who thought they were going to fight their way through the post-apocalyptic world, these days it tends to be people that just want to try to remember how to live outdoors. You know, tapping again my friend Paul and his own school, I remember talking to Paul one day about my early attempts to offer classes here at the homestead, and I was telling him, you know, Paul, I get people expressing a lot of interest in taking classes, but they don't come. I offer classes in tracking. I offer classes in bush navigation, learning to navigate by the sun, by the contours of the land, you know, toss your GPS and find your way the old way and such. And he had said, Cliff, that's because people have forgotten so much, and you're not aware of that because of where you've lived so much of your life, where that was just how you lived. But people have forgotten how to make a campfire. People have forgotten just how to lie down on the ground. One lady was telling me, very nice lady I speak with now and then by way of the internet, she's off in Ireland, was telling me that she had offered a class. Actually, I think she's in Germany, but anyway, she used to offer to take people out on these shamanic meditations in the bush, and sometimes they would come and they would have to walk over this gentle slope to get to the meditation site, and sometimes they would be so terrified of going over a slope or walking across a slope because it wasn't paved. They didn't know how to keep their grip on the ground without it. So people have become deeply alienated from Earth, and we are beings of the Earth, whether or not we like to admit it, like to deal with it. You know, we have this delusion that we're evolving. You hear all the time, it's very popular in media, we're evolving, we're an urbanized species. No, we're not. Human beings have not significantly evolved in something like 50 to 100,000 years, and more actually the science is telling us that our species is probably considerably older than what we think it is, 200,000, maybe more years old. We haven't evolved in all that time. We've changed culturally. We have the ability to create changes, but we haven't evolved. We are still instinctively and physically very much the same creatures we were 200,000 years ago. We're a couple inches taller because we're better at nutrition now, but we're still essentially the same creatures.
Well, the body...
And
the body,
we need that Earth Mother.
You're right. And the body hasn't changed, but perhaps the which is the vehicle of our consciousness, this body and the mind, perhaps it's about... That's another part of it. We're being asked to, as you say, become conscious, and the tool that we use for interpreting our consciousness, our brain, we need to kick it into gear. It's like the kid in the Stephen King story who gets hit with the hockey puck and his brain turns on, you know. Perhaps that's part of it. I think it is. I do think it is, but... the connection to the Earth Mother is also something that will, I think, turn our brains on.
I think you're right. And in fact, I know you're right. Did you see that movie Avatar?
I did.
Who didn't see Avatar? Avatar was a great movie, and I remember that moment in the near the beginning of the movie where the hero first meets the leading lady, and she tells him that he needs to learn to see, and he says, well, teach me to see, and she said, nobody can teach you to see. And I thought that part of the movie was so amusing because I've had the pleasure of knowing Aboriginals up in the northern bush who still live very simply, who would use very, very similar expressions. Back in my days when I was just a rookie living out in the bush, you know, it's just, you have to learn to see the world around. You have to learn not to just look at the tracks. You have to see the tracks, you know, because the language of the animals is in those tracks. The language of the weather is in the clouds. We have to develop that connection so that we can see. And what I find, and one of the things that Seasons of the Sacred Earth is about, that seeing is not just seeing the physical world. It's seeing with depth. And it does allow you to see the physical world, but eventually you start to see through that physical world. It's a very shamanic experience. It's like a shamanic journey. You know, Seasons of the Sacred Earth, people have written that you write of nature and you bring the spiritual side out of that nature. To me, that's just the seeing. There's language in the clouds. There's spirits in the wind. And I hear the owls hoot at night, and there's magic in those hoots. That's part of that process of seeing, where we're looking deeper. We're not just hearing the physical sensation, but we're hearing the spirit that underlies it. And eventually, when you look deeply enough, you see that, you know, in Zen, it's taught that everything, Buddhism, everything lives in harmony, everything is a unity. And it is true. I don't personally think, this is just my interpretation, everything is not one, but there is a deep and profound harmony. One thing affects the next, affects the next, affects the next, and it's like a grand song. And we start to be able to see into that song as we develop that connection with nature.
That's true. I think it was Fraser who wrote in his Golden Bough about the law of conjugation, or once touched, always touched. It's the pebble in the pond and the ripples going out. There's no way to not be connected to everything.
That is true.
It's the fabulous web of life when you come out of it. I understand exactly what you mean as a flower essence practitioner and maker. I had to, as you would say, see, but I learned to develop a form of communication between myself and the flowers, and it's gone way beyond flowers and plants and trees, but I saw the language of the flower and the way it responded to the elements, to the wind, to the sun at night. the number of petals on it, the colors, the way it was shaped and formed. I mean, there's a language there that we intuit, and if we connect with it, it brings all of what we call spiritual connection together.
Yes. You know, we're remarkable creatures partly because we have such an ability to see. I wrote in Seasons of the Sacred Earth in the first chapter, He Who Walks Among the Trees was the name of that chapter, and I wrote in there as I described a tale, one of the many tales about the natural world and our family's interaction with it on the homestead. I touched upon how we live in this world where we need to learn to focus and to sense all that's within there and how our senses work. And our senses are really created to help us see and develop that connection. But I know that as a rule we forget just how much. One of the reasons I know is because it's only a myth that we have just five senses. Human beings actually have 16 senses. We have a huge plethora of senses. We tend to think sight and hearing and taste and touch and smell, and there's our senses. We have vestibulation, that's our ability to sense our relationship to gravity. We have our thermal sensation, that's our ability to sense heat. We have proprioception, which is our ability to sense our position in time and space. And we have many other senses as well. Every occupational therapist is aware of all the different senses that we have, and we may have more senses. The depth of our ability to sense is only just now being discovered. I wrote in that chapter about how among all the creatures that exist, we're pretty sure we're unique in that, you know, a bat perhaps can hear higher pitches than we can, and so can a cat, and a whale, like a bat, can make pictures out of sound and whatnot. But no other creature that we know of can listen to an orchestra and hear the harmony and the melody and the counter-melody and the beats and the counter-beats. No other creature can listen to the 40 or 50 or 80 instruments, whatever is playing in that orchestra, and hear if there's a single flute off pitch. But we can. We have an amazing depth and description. This, I think, is a gift that's given to us to interact with the world. So imagine how we starve ourselves if our lives are lived based around a computer or a data device, which can only play to two of those 16 senses, or we live a life that's confined indoors or to a setting where we're surrounded by concrete instead of the rich interaction of forest and brook and rain and things that we would get in a more natural setting. This is one of the reasons we crave these things. Our own neurological development is deeply tied into interaction with that world. Human beings physically cannot properly develop unless they have a chance to exercise and climb trees and balance over streams and such. This is becoming more and better documented. That was the subject of David Lube's best-selling book about a decade ago called Last Child in the Woods. That connection is being lost, and that's why we're seeing the development of things like so much childhood depression, attention deficit disorder, as well as this deep emotional malaise that's coming more and more to characterize society.
Yes, I agree with you, Cliff, 100%. And I give myself my own checklist there when you're ticking off all of the things I am not getting enough of, because I tend to isolate. I'm one of those folks. I get very creative, and I will take time to go within, and then I burst out. It's all or nothing many times. But that's not as harmonious as it could be. It's not as healthy as it could be. We need a consistency. That's the word. Consistency.
A diet.
Yes.
We need a diet of the world around us.
A lot of people I've known in my life are amazed that I'm so willing to go out to sea and be there for a few days, that I did it as a youngster growing up and in my early 20s. And I said, oh my gosh, it's a miracle. You're out to sea for 2 days. It's like taking the garbage out of your head, you know. And
yeah.
they all say, it's very few people that I see spark to the adventure of it and the breathtaking nature of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
People are more comfortable, really. But when you talk about somebody being afraid to walk a slope, it makes me pause. That makes me pause. Gee. I think the last time we spoke, you told me, too, that more people than you realize are afraid of nature. And I have since then spoken with people who, most of the people I know, are not actually like that, and yet they have experience with that kind of reaction.
Oh, yes, yes, most certainly true. I think I'd base that off of, I was telling you about how people that I work with over here, I try to, they're dealing with depression, they're dealing with being cut off, or they're dealing with, I mean, many things that we perceive as mental health issues are linked to physical inactivity, letting oneself be cut off from the world around you, from the connections of a life close to friends and nature and family and such. And so I try to get them out and doing things and active. And of course, I've seen so many people just terrified of the idea, oh, my God, I can't go outside. I live a mile out of town. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, there are coyotes. There are bears. You know, I've even known a few people that were terrified of the deer. People are afraid, and it's unduly afraid. You probably noticed that over the past week, I've been offering to teach courses following these two young women in Nova Scotia that claimed they were attacked by bears. Now, I know they weren't attacked by bears. I know a good deal about bear behavior. I know how they behave in the wild, and I've tracked them more times than I can count. And they weren't attacked by an aggressive bear. They probably, my guess is, they came across a bear and the bear got close to them and the bear was curious or maybe habituated. And anyway, so the bear was used to humans and they were afraid of it and they ran away. And so now they're telling the story. So I've been offering to teach courses because what's going to happen is people are going to get afraid. They're going to ask the government to do a bear call like they're doing a coyote call now here in Nova Scotia. People are going to want that, and so I've been offering to teach courses on how to interact with bears and how bears behave and what to expect, because people are afraid. They're afraid of that world out their doors, and it's like being afraid of the boogeyman. It's like being afraid of the monster under your bed. They're afraid because they don't understand. If you understood, you would know that there's not so much to be afraid of. And look, as I'm telling you this, I'm not some starry-eyed person who's been watching Bambi too much. I've lived a lot of my life in the bush. I've been charged by 3 grizzly bears. I've been hunted. I'm one of the few people in North America that actually say I've been hunted for more than a week by a grizzly bear, actively hunted. I know bears can be aggressive, but I know what a bear looks like when it's aggressive, and it's extremely rare, and probably the only reason it happened to me was that particular bear happened to be too young to know. It was old, big enough to be dangerous, but too young to know to avoid humans, and I was deep in the bush. It didn't have an opportunity for much experience with humans anyway. But bears around here, they would never do something like that, and people need to become aware of that. They need to learn how to interact. One of the things I used to see in Alaska in terms of getting people involved in the bush, when they went into a wilderness area like Denali, the Park Service offered courses on how to interact safely with wildlife, what to do if a bear approached, what to do if you saw wolves, what to do if you saw a wolverine, the other big predators. None of that happens here. People have no idea. The solution is there's a predator around, and you run away or you try to kill it. There really needs to be work done to put people back in touch with that world in a sense where they aren't afraid. That's why I do things like I take people out for walks in the woods by night so they can learn the woods aren't terrifying by night. There's a porcupine that's not interested in you, and that's a bear. The bear just wants to go over there and eat the ants in that log. It's not interested in you. They need to be able to get out and do those kind of things. But how can you do that? We live in a world. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, you were talking about about listening to the owl, and I thought, geez, that's the kind of television that people should be watching, is out in the woods or even out on the deck in the dark, laying back, listening to the owl. Because if you listen long enough, you hear the languages.
You start to see into it, yes.
Yeah.
And you know, when drawing back to that example from the movie Avatar, whoever came up with that line, I know that a lot of anthropologists were involved in that movie and consulted on the script and such, and whoever came up with that line had to have drawn it, because that idea that nobody can teach you to see or perceive the depth within the world, that is true. You can't get that depth by an occasional exposure now and then, like 2 weeks, your two-week vacation at the end of the year is not enough. Virtual reality on a computer won't cut it at all. You need a diet of those kind of things to develop that sight. And in fact, this is exactly why I post what I do on Facebook and on my webpage. It's not because I think that this can help people see, but if I can make somebody inspired enough or even envious enough that they will get out and do it for themselves, that is the goal, that they can get out there and learn to see for themselves. I'm not involved in activism. I used to be all for the groups like Earth First and Greenpeace, and I still am. I wish them well. But personally, I don't do it because I believe it's fairly futile just trying to make rules that people can't do stuff anymore. You have to show them why they should. You have to teach them to see. So the reason I've written books like Seasons of the Sacred Earth and teach the courses that I do and take the approach that I do is to try to inspire more people to learn to see again.
Well, I think that you're doing a fabulous job of that, but what I would call it is you're developing people's curiosity beyond the fear. You know, when you relate your experiences and teach people through your writing about what you know, what you felt, then they're curious, you know?
Yeah.
They get
emails every week, people asking stuff.
They want some, you know, that's the thing. They want some. And so they either will or they won't go, you know. Most of us make our living from that urban environment, so there are so many challenges to modern life, aren't there?
I suppose. I don't really stick myself into it enough to quite be in the role of it. But yeah, there are certainly enough and too many. We hang an awful lot of distractions upon ourselves, don't we? I was thinking of a kind of a rhetorical question just a moment ago as you were speaking, as you were talking about drawing our livings from that urban environment. And others have asked this: how on earth is it that we of a species have allowed ourselves to devise a society in which we immerse ourselves in activities we don't enjoy for the vast majority? In fact, if you work a normal period, you know, 50 out of 52 weeks in a year, for what is that? That's about 95% of your life. You're devoting a great deal of your time to being someplace that you don't especially care to be and doing something you don't especially care to do. How do we let ourselves do that? And then how do we go about remediating that? Is it possible that people can live daily more connected? Is it possible that people can find a way to give their lives more depth and to allow themselves to see? Well, like I wrote at the end of Seasons, everybody doesn't have to go out into the sticks and live like we've done, but they do have to go out their door, and they do have to find their own path, their own means and solutions. But it requires going outside the door and outside the box and finding that solution that's going to let you get back in touch with the things that really, really matter anymore. Something that living close to the land has taught me over the years very, very firmly is that the things that so many think really matter, they just don't matter. The next promotion doesn't matter. The bigger house doesn't matter. The shinier car doesn't matter. Because at the end of your life, I've talked to a lot of people, my work as a psychotherapist, at the end of their lives, At the end of your life, none of these people go back and think, damn, I wish I'd gotten the next promotion up. Oh, I sure wish I'd been able to buy that 4,500-square-foot house and move out of that 3,200-square-foot house. They all think, I wish I'd spent more time with my family. I wish I'd gone and hiked Yellowstone Park. I wish I had swum in the ocean in the South Pacific just once, or touched a whale, or looked at the stars and really let myself dream. Those are the kind of things that they wish. How do we let ourselves as a species spend our whole life diverting ourselves from those things that we know are really important? How do we let ourselves as a society come to that? And until we can answer those things personally, I don't think we have a hope and a prayer of fixing our problems as a society, as an international society. How can we possibly fix the things that are really important when right now we're so deluded about what matters?
No, that was well said, Cliff. That was well said. I couldn't agree with you more. We are deluded. We're very deluded. And you're right. Mostly, and there are a lot of people, I will say this, there are a lot of people who are trying very hard to restructure their lives so that they might be able to live them within the boundaries of a more satisfying and fulfilling life that allows them to go and hike Yosemite and to be closer to their family and to do something that they feel good about doing, even if it's making lamps in their garage or something. There are a lot of folks that are turning to that. The reality of, you know, the paying the bills and all of that. It's a challenge when you wake up and get conscious, and you say, oh my goodness, this is not a fulfilling life. How am I going to? Well, it's quite a dilemma to figure it out financially, too. That's the other thing, the peerage over you.
That's true, and that's the question people wrestle with a great deal. I'll present to you the question that I usually present back. So what happens if you walk away? What happens if you just say, I quit, I'm done, and you walk away and you let it all resolve itself? What then?
There you go.
The banks don't collapse. The world doesn't stop running. You get this peerage that's over you saying, well, there's going to be this terrible consequence and that terrible consequence. But if you have decided, well, I'm going to live outside of that narrow scheme of things, those consequences don't much matter anymore. And I'm not advising by any means being irresponsible. I mean, we all have to be responsible, I believe, for our own livings. I'd be lying if I didn't say I work very hard. I work several days a week as a therapist, and I run the homestead, and I write, and we're constantly at work harvesting or trimming horse hooves or fixing fences and whatnot. It's not about not working. It's about being able to define our own terms for it.
Yes.
And if society will, as it stands right now, aim to make that impossible, because society as it stands right now is about this very limited idea called a growth economy. If we're going to redefine our lives, we have to redefine ourselves outside of those standards. A couple of years ago, when I stepped back from the health career that I could have had, people thought that was crazy. But I made the decision. That didn't matter. It doesn't matter. This is the life that matters. I will not let with my training, I could have done all kinds of things in terms of health. I could have set up an office in a town and made hundreds of dollars an hour, every hour of the day if I'd wanted to. I'm not exaggerating. That would have been nothing to do it. But I decided to step outside of that. It didn't matter, because knowing how... This is part of seeing, knowing the kind of life you're supposed to live, and then establishing that life regardless of anybody else's superficial perceptions. To me, that's what's important. And I want everybody to live like I want them to live. I want people to be able to realize what's important for themselves and create their own impetus and learn to step outside of the narrow fears of wondering if everybody else, by society at large, is going to approve. It doesn't matter. That's part of the process of individuation, as Jung would have described it, you know, learning to be an individual who follows higher moral and ethical guidelines, just defining yourself and being okay with that.
Yes, agreed. You know, we've come to the end of our show. It's always such a pleasure to have you on. And I get a lot of people listening to you in the archive. So that tells you something. Folks want to hear what you've got to say. You're doing a powerful messaging.
Well, thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you on. I hope you'll come back.
And I'd be happy to go on. It's always a pleasure.
By the next time, I will have the book under my belt too. I'm a baddie.
Well, it happens to be in stock for a change, so order it quickly.
Okay, well, I'll take that one because I got a little extra. I will do that. I want to remind folks, too, that you have a wonderful blog that has just all kinds of wonderful information on it. I go over there and read a little here and read a little there. It's like a nice little break. And Homestead Skills and Naturalist Lore and Cauldron of Enchantment. I mean, you've really done a wonderful job with your blog, and that's a WordPress blog, which is just look up Cliff, you'll find it there. You're also available on Facebook. Is there any place else you'd like people to know about where they can find your book besides Amazon?
It's at most any bookstore, Amazon, local chapters, or Barnes & Noble down in the States. It's a major publication, so it should be at just about any bookstore. If it's not there, they could have it brought in just by request.
Thank you so much for coming and being with us, or with me today. And I do look forward to the next time. I always enjoy these talks with you. Thank you, Cliff.
You're quite welcome, Gwendolyn.
Enjoy your evening. And
I will do that.
I want to thank everybody for listening in this evening. And next week we'll be back with Nicole. I do want to put the blog site into our chat room so you can find it. And that is it for this evening. Cliff, have a wonderful week and weekend. I'm sorry, weekend. And enjoy your world. I look forward to reading more about it on the pages of Facebook. And that's it for this evening.
Good night, Gwen.
Good night.